AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Podcast this week, we ask Ethan Cohen and Trisha Cook, the team behind Drive Away Dolls, what's the rumpus? Plus, we talk to the director of new Pierce Brosnan thriller Fast Charlie, Philip Noyce. All that and more on the movie podcast that has just arrived back from Sheffield and was disappointed to find that the fish and chip shop that was once Sean Bean's favourite and that offered not only a Sean Bean meat feast and chips, presumably not made with actual Sean Bean, but also a Boromir special of chips, cheese and gravy topped with Lord of the Onion Rings is closed permanently. Why? How?
Is it because I didn't call it the Onion Ring?
That would be confusing.
That would be worse than what they went with. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. We are in the studio. Me and my two colleagues of such lethal cunning this week. We are fresh off the train from Sheffield, where last night we did another triumphant live show. Going to say triumphant.
It was a triumph.
Hollywood Reporter says triumphant.
Boffo, probably.
Boffo box office for...
Soft sesha.
Yes. Nick's pick sticks mix licks. That's what we were doing last night. And we weren't licking anything. Oh God. What happens in the Travelodge stays in the Travelodge. Anyway, I'm joined by my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Sadly, neither of them stayed in the Travelodge later here. Helen O'Hara is here, our geek queen.
Hello.
James Dyer, our great big fucking nerd, is also here.
Hello. And excuse me if I feel slightly subdued. I'm suffering from post-Sheffield Travelodge disorder, whereby I just feel a bit scuzzy. But I would like to give a big shout out to one of our regular listeners who I ran into in the foyer of the Travelodge just before the live show, and he went, "Oh, you're James Dyer from the Empire Podcast." I went, "Oh, hi, how are you?" And I said, "Oh, great, are you here for the show? Are you coming?" And he just went, "No." And that was it.
How did he say it?
He didn't, to be fair, he did not have a Sheffield accent, but I felt it would be more appropriate.
No, he didn't. It's unlikely he had a Sheffield accent, given that he was staying in a Travelodge in Sheffield, indicating that he came from somewhere else.
I see what you're saying. But the thing is, so he came from somewhere else, came all the way to Sheffield, stayed in a Travelodge, where we were doing a show, fan of the Empire Podcast, so much so that he could identify us by sight and wasn't coming to the show.
I know.
A wise man, to be honest.
He has been dealt with.
He has. He's blacklisted.
Oh, no. Yeah.
He could have turned the show from triumphant to mega triumphant.
That's right.
According to Variety.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Giga triumphant.
Giga triumphant, indeed.
Mecha triumphant it versus was giga triumphant.
A giga triumphant gig. It was really fun. It was really fun. Now over 50% of the way through our live tour.
Three gigs is a recommendation.
Three gigs.
The tour will one day be finished.
Yeah. It is. Yes. It will be finished very, very soon. We have two dates left, folks, of the Evening with the Empire podcast tour, in partnership, of course, with M&M's. And we're going to be in Dublin next week. Now, tickets are very, very nearly sold out for that. And when I say nearly sold out, I think we're down to the last 20 or so. The last 20 or so tickets. So if you want to come and see us in Dublin, it's going to be, the crack's going to be mighty. Mighty crack.
Can we not
come and see my mighty crack? And Dublin next week at the Laughter Lounge. That's where we're going to be. Jesus, Mary and Joseph will also be there. James will be there. Helen will be there. Alex Godfrey will be there from the Empire podcast. I don't know whether that is an attraction or a deterrent. But anyway, it's going to be a lot of fun. And then a week after that, we're going to be in Salford/Manchester, rounding off the tour on March 28th. And that's going to be an amazing show as well. And tickets are selling very, very fast for that also. So do get on it should you wish to come and see us. Or just arrange a night out in Manchester and then run into us in the foyer and then tell us to our faces you're not going to come to our show. That's always fun. That's always a fun thing to do. But yes, tickets for those are available via the venue. So it's Salford Keys for Salford or the Laughter Lounge, don't laugh, in Dublin next week. Or you can go to ticketmaster.co.uk or you can go to empireonline.com/podtour. Anyway, enough talking about Sheffield and Manchester and Dublin and tours and where people can buy tickets and all that sort of stuff. Let's get into it. Let's get into a listener question. And this one comes on Twitter, as they all do, because I'm still on Twitter, which is Twitter, not X. Come on. Honestly.
Agreed.
What the hell? What is your newest favorite movie, as in the newest movie that's in your top 10? That is a good question.
I know the answer. Very good question.
And do you here's another. There's an addendum. This is from Queer Murcia, who asked, or you actually pronounced this correctly, didn't you, Helen?
Queer Murcia,
who asked a question a couple of weeks ago. Do you think you'll ever have a new favorite?
Never.
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah.
You think you'll never have
a new favorite film ever? That's
your favorite film of all time is Aliens.
My favorite film is that, because the thing is, it's not about the quality of the film. It is 100% about the time you saw the film and what it means to you. And I don't think it is possible to.
But what about you fell madly in love with somebody and you saw, like, on your first date with this amazing person, right?
I went to see Dune Part 2.
You go and see, like, Dune Messiah, or you go to see, like, Aliens, that James Cameron has returned to the franchise and now he's made Aliens. And it's like a 5-star masterpiece, like, nailed on.
Yeah.
I'm just saying it could check. I think it is foolish to say that you'll never.
No,
afterwards you go back to the Travelodge and you have the most mind-blowing lovemaking of your life
in the reception to 4 a.m.
Oh no.
Which is why we were asked to leave in Paris.
Oh,
I'm enjoying the fact we've now ensured you can't cut that bit out. But no, I'm 100% laying my life on the line, certain that it is not possible for my favourite film to be displaced.
Yeah, you're setting your ways, though. I don't agree.
I just think the nature... Same with favourite song as well. I just don't believe...
What's your favourite song?
What's my actual favourite song? Do you know what? I don't know that I have one. But I have a favourite album. But
what's your favourite album?
My favourite album is 10 by Pearl Jam.
That's a great album.
Yes. But again, it's because of the period of my life when I used to listen to it and the memories that it brings back and all of these various things. But that Aliens was a seminal film for me, as was the original Star Wars. They are part of my DNA. They are woven into the fabric of my being and nothing can ever displace them, ever.
Good to see you've got an open mind, Helen.
Yeah.
Do you think you might have a new favourite one day?
Yeah,
and what's the most recent film that has entered your top 10?
In my top 10, possibly Endgame, probably Hunt for the Wilder People. Those are both up there pretty
good,
high.
Good choices, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like really believe in lists is my actual issue with this question. I don't. If I love something, I don't feel the need to rank it. I assemble a top 10 when I have to and I name favourite films when I have to. But it's the most amorphous blob of a group of things that I love. So,
what's your favourite song?
These Arms of Mine by Otis Redding, let's say. But then there's about 1,000 songs in, you know, the number 2 spot, as it were.
What's your favourite album? 12 years we've been doing this podcast, we've never asked this question.
It's true.
I don't know.
Take the fifth.
I'd have to think.
It's interesting.
It might be something like Rattlin' Hum or Joshua Tree or something like that, actually.
No, you're treating
it. Or and Pearl Jam's 10 actually genuinely would be up there.
She's buttering up the Irish.
I'm ready
for next week.
Oh, I don't need to.
Busting out your Clannad CDs.
Yeah. Trying to give little known Irish band U2 a bit of a leg up there. Okay, this is interesting because I do have this sometimes with music in that it's very rare. I think you get set in your ways musically very, very early on in your life and your favourite bands tend to be your favourite bands. It's very rare that a new band or a new artist will gatecrash my top 10 of all time. I guess the most recent artist who gatecrashed my top 10, because I'm very, very closed off to new music, would be Idlewild and Roddy Woomble and people like that. And I'm scared of new music. No, not as in, when I see Dua Lipa, I make the sign of the cross. I don't do that. But what I mean is, if an artist that I love brings out a new album, I'm sometimes actively scared of it. There are a couple of artists, I'm not going to name them, there are a couple of my favorite bands who have produced new music in the last 3-4 years, and I haven't listened to it because I'm scared it'll be terrible.
But I think you have to keep your mind open to new things. Otherwise, you do wither and die.
But
James.
I'm not like that with films. I'm not like that with films whatsoever. Every day is Christmas Eve. Every film has the potential to be my second favorite of all time. And because like James, I'm afraid my number one is locked in. It is Evil Dead 2, and that ain't ever changing.
But like, I don't want to make a big like political thing of this, but I do also. I'm going to. this idea that, you know, yes, of course, the things we saw as young people shape us and mold us and set our tastes to a degree. And bind the galaxy together.
It's not even
but like that kind of thinking that nothing better is possible is
no,
why...
No, 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 that's not what we're saying.
No,
that's not what we're saying.
No, let him finish.
No, but nothing better for me is possible. That thinking is what leads to this endless churn of remakes, requels, you know, and rehashes of stuff that we already know we love. It's what leads legacy musicians to have all of this kind of economic power and new acts to struggle. And I'm not saying, like, it's obviously not because James loves Aliens. That's not the problem. But it is because, you know, we all have to be open to new things and we all have to try to give people a chance. I know, but like, I mean, I know that this is as old as humanity. This is not a modern problem. But I think the influence of the algorithm and the influence of the way our culture currently works on our preferences could be disastrous. And that's, I guess, maybe what worries me a little bit when we get too close.
But what I'm saying is I'm not like that with film.
No, I know. I get
I'm very open to new experiences with film. Yes, Evil Dead 2 is pretty much set in stone as my favorite film of all time. But I want that experience where I come out of the cinema walking on air, dancing with joy. I cannot wait to see it again. And Wonka, I had it with Wonka, where I was just like, oh my God, I'm transported. I'm lifted.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, one of my favorite experiences in the cinema in a long, long time. And I want that every single time I walk in. And do I get it? Do I fuck? Anyway.
But I think music is more pronounced in this regard than film, but I think they're both affected by it. That it's not just about, you know, the content of the art. It's about the emotional payload that it brings with it. I think music very much so. This is not about what it sounds like aesthetically, it's how it makes you feel. And so it all depends on the periods in your life. And most of the intense formative periods of your life will happen during that kind of
childhood,
adolescent period.
During your formative years.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, well, completely that. But for me, so the weird thing, so in terms of artists who've kind of sneaked in, and I'm very resistant to new music, the Taylor Swift thing that we talk about, part of that is because when I listened to Evermore, it was during that first year of the pandemic. And then, Folklore, I should say. When Folklore came out, it was the summer of the pandemic, 2020, and then Evermore was the winter. And that's pretty much all I listened to during the pandemic, which was an incredibly emotionally intense period of time. Probably the most intense period of time I've had since my formative years because it was unprecedented. Mm. And I think because of that, those albums have such intense emotional recall for me because I listened to them during that time. And that's why her music kind of almost sits alongside the music that I loved when I was growing up because it has that same component to it. So, I mean, I'm thinking, were there any films I watched during that period?
A global catastrophe.
Maybe that's what we need.
To...
Yeah, no, I need that.
I would say people like Lizzo and Janelle Monáe have definitely gatecrashed my sort of favorite artists in the last couple of years. Even nearly Dua Lipa, actually. She's got some banging tunes. Freaking love her. I'm very excited that she's at Glastonbury this year. But I don't know. I do think like a lot of comfort music is what you listen to as a teenager. I did a lot of like soul music and stuff during that time, and that is and you too, yes, because they hadn't given everyone a free album and alienated them for life.
Forced it upon them. Take
the
free thing. Fuck you.
So I do get that. I do, and I'm not saying, you know, I understand why we love the things we have loved forever. Mm. Because I do too. I love, you know, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. I love The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, even though I haven't read it in a lot of years. They're part of who I am. But at the same time, I want to believe that a book could come out tomorrow and blow my mind to that degree. I want to believe that there is a new Aliens somewhere down the line that is going to blow me away, you know?
That's a really interesting point because my feeling towards books is very different. My favorite books... Many of them I have, in fact, all of my favorite books, I would say, I have read in the last 20 years. Mm. And one of them, which is Empire of the Vampire, I've read very recently. Mm. So I think my narrow-mindedness doesn't extend to my literary intake, which is curious.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's maybe move on. I will say, I just remembered Priscilla Ann, who's an amazing singer-songwriter, has gay crashed, maybe my top 15. Check her out if you haven't already. Priscilla A-H-N. Priscilla Ann. She's really, really great. Anyway, this comes from Daniel Watkins. Daniel the W on Twitter. This week's pod will be out on the Ides of March. Yes, yes indeed. Ooh. The 15th of March, which is a Ryan Gosling film. What is the best Ryan Gosling film?
Well, I mean... He was in Denis Villeneuve's Blade Runner 2049, so that's up there for me.
Okay, but what is the best Ryan Gosling film?
I mean, for you, obviously La La Land, I guess. It's kind of up
it's,
there.
I have prepared a quick, off the top of my head, top 10.
Go on then.
Top 5. Top
go
five.
On then, let's hear it.
Lars and the Real Girl at number 5.
Good shout.
Crazy Stupid Love.
Very good shout.
Drive. Mm. The Nice Guys.
Excellent shout.
And I'm about to blow your mind. Barbie.
I mean, also a good shout. Mm. You didn't list The Notebook.
I did not. I'm not a Notebook girl. Really? I don't know what I missed. I missed the boat, or I missed the rainstorm, or just, I missed the house building.
Didn't
I
get under your moleskin.
It did not. I saw it, I think, after a lot of the hype had already happened, and I was a bit like, it seems fine, but it's never been one of my big swoony romances. So yeah, maybe I need to go back and watch it again. Mm. But The Nice Guys is great. I think I like him best in poking fun at himself mode. Yep. Like I did love Drive at the time, and he's super cool in that and super like restrained and drawn back. And I thought it was, I really, really enjoyed it. But when he was doing the absolute minimum almost, you know.
Yeah.
But him in comedy mode in The Nice Guys and Barbie, I think is really hard to beat. And actually Crazy Stupid Love as well.
Yes.
Is very much him poking fun at himself.
And of course,
Emma Stone
La
poking
La Land.
Fun at him.
He is very, very funny.
Never heard of it.
But also like Blade Runner 2049. And I know I believe Empire Magazine called it their film of the year, in the year that it came out, the year of our Lord, 2017? I love it. I do love it. But there has been quite the backlash against it since then. I think it's now no longer held in the regard that it maybe once was. Even Denis Villeneuve massively seems to regret doing it.
I massively regret watching it. So, yes.
I don't think he liked playing in someone else's pool. Like, he didn't like existing in someone else's world. I think he wishes he'd done his own thing. But there you go.
Yeah. Do you have a top five, Jimbo?
Do I have a top five? I don't know if I have a number top five. Blade Runner would definitely be in there. The Nice Guys might be my number one, I would say. La La Land would probably be in there as well.
Yes.
Crazy Stupid Love would 100% be in there too.
Big Short? He's very, very good in The Big Short.
He's very good, and it's a very good film. Possibly. That might be in there.
Any love for Half Nelson? Anyone love Half Nelson?
No, but I could go for Young Hercules. What?
It's no Xena.
He got nominated for an Oscar for Half Nelson.
I thought you were about to say for Young Hercules.
For Young Hercules. Well, he's been around for so long. He is, I think, older than time. He's only 43 or 44. Which is wild because he's been around as a movie star for about 20 years now.
Yeah, he was in Remember the Titans, wasn't he?
He was.
I don't remember that.
Well, somebody didn't listen to the actual title of the film and obey. And he was a musketeer.
He was. He's been around for many, many years, but as a movie star, as an actual above the line, hey, I'm Ryan Gosling, go and see this movie because I'm in it. It's probably Notebook was a breakthrough for him, but Murder by Numbers, 2002, Remember the Titans, Murder by Numbers, he's one of the killers, isn't he? Mm-hmm. He and Michael Pitt, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, I think so.
A Sandra Bullock thriller. Then Half Nelson, Fracture. You ever seen Fracture? That's a good film.
Which
Gregory
one was
Hoblit. It's
is that the one where he's a Nazi?
No. No, unless I've completely misread that film. He is a lawyer who goes. He has a battle of wits with Anthony Hopkins. Anthony Hopkins kills his wife at the beginning of the movie and basically goes, I bloody killed my wife. And Ryan Gosling's like, I'm going to put you in prison for murdering your wife.
We're going to kill the wife.
And Anthony Hopkins is like, well, where's your evidence? Hey, oh, no bloody evidence, boy. Oh, even though I've admitted to it. And then they have like a battle of wits and then there's like reversals and twists and stuff. And the thing is, at the time, he was like, I guess in his late 20s, and he just looks a little bit too young to be a crusading DA or assistant DA or whatever he was going to be in that. But it's a good film. Gregory Hoblit, who directed Primal Fear. Blue Valentine, bit of rumpy, rumpy pumpy, raunchy rumpy pump.
It's very good, but it's a little bit sad for the top five I was putting together.
Drive, the best film in which Ryan Gosling beats someone to death in a lift. That's fun.
I mean, it doesn't do it the way Cap does, let's be honest.
Yeah, Cap. We should do lift scenes.
Lift fights.
We should do lift scenes.
I mean, Drive is good. It is good. I just did not love it anywhere near as much as really anyone else.
About his man duology of First Man and then The Gray Man? He took 4 years off after First Man. In fairness, First Man feels like it lasted 4 years, so I can see why. But, First Man and then The Gray Man.
First Man made me a Gray Man. I enjoyed The Gray Man. It's quite forgettable, but it's a lot of fun. Chris Evans is so much fun in that.
Yeah,
It's a giggle. I liked it.
Yeah, it felt like a proper studio film at a time where we weren't getting very many of them. Yeah. So I enjoyed it for that.
But it feels apt we're talking about him this week, right? Because he won the Oscars. Even though he didn't win an Oscar,
he won the Oscars.
Yeah, he won all the
without
Oscars,
winning an Oscar.
Yeah. I mean, for his best original song performance for I'm Just Ken, which was, I think, better than any of the actual nominees for Best Picture this year, including Barbie.
Yeah, so the performance of I'm Just Ken at this year's Oscars should win Best Picture at next year's Oscars.
No, it should have won Best Picture at this year's Oscars. They should have been able to very, very quickly go, Best Picture this year was Ryan Gosling's performance of I'm Just Ken.
Just
my eyes see.
Yeah,
it was. My eyes see. Ryan Gosling, I'm Just Ken. Oh!
And God bless all the other Kens for turning up, or four of them.
Yes.
So Kingsley Benadir, Simu Liu,
Shuti Gatwa, and Scott Evans.
Shuti Gatwa, who turned up to the Oscars in body armor, and I love him.
He's a very cool dresser.
What was he expecting to happen?
You know?
He was just going for LA, I guess. It's called fashion. Look it up.
Okay. All right. Yeah. If you say so. All right. My top five.
Yeah.
We've had Helen's. We've had James's after a fashion. I tell you what's not going to be on there. Only God Forgives.
Only Chris Forgets.
Yeah.
Oh, never forgive. Never forget.
Never forget.
All right. At five, The Big Short.
Mm. Fun movie.
Solid.
Great film. He's very, very funny in it. Yeah. There's a commonality here. He's very, very funny in most of these. Number four, La La Land.
Yes. Another Day of Sun.
Number three, Barbie.
Far too low.
Number two, I've completely miscounted. It's number two. I might have to put the Grey Man at number two. Oh, Jesus, help us all. Number two, you know what? I'm going to redo that. Number five, Drive. Drive five. Mm. Five a Drive. Number four, Barbie. Number three, yes, I've changed my mind. Number three, La La Land.
No.
Number two, The Big Short. Number one, The Nice Guys, in which he is legitimately god-level funny. Yeah. Just so, so good. Notably, we didn't discuss The Ides of March. Anyone want
to... It's not very good.
It's fine.
Yeah.
I would have to, have a real run-up to remember what the plot was.
Same here. It's dirty politics. That's all I kind of remember about it.
Yeah, that's all I can tell about it. I think he thinks he's the one outwitting people and then he gets outwitted. Is it something like that?
Number six on your list is basically what we're all...
No.
It would be lower than that, but you're fine.
All right, let's move on. If you want to have your question read out on the Emperor Podcast, you can get in touch with me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Hewitt. You can slide into my DMs. You can reply to any of my tweets. Once you've stopped laughing, of course, or any of my panicked shout-outs, usually on a Thursday. At the moment, usually on a Thursday when we're on a train on the way home from wherever we have just been the night before. All right, shall we have a guest?
Yeah.
All right, bear in mind that one of these guests hasn't happened yet. Although I said that last week with DeWanda Wise. DeWanda Wise! And it was really, really fun. And it happened in the end. It was really, really fun. So we can have Philip Noyce, who hasn't happened yet and may not happen. Or we can have Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook, who have happened.
Yay!
Let's have Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook.
All right, let's have Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook. Ethan Coen, you know him, of course, as one half of the Coen brothers. The brothers called Coen, Joel Coen and Ethan Coen, who between them wrote, produced, and directed some of the greatest movies in the history of American cinema. We could do a Coen Brothers ranking right now, but frankly, we do not have the time. But what's your favorite Coen Brothers movie, Helen? Go.
Hail Caesar.
That's insane. That's insane.
Fuck?
I fucking love it.
What? No.
That's a proxy then. Fine. Whatever.
Not much better, but it's fine. I'll accept, for kids. Sure. And all that sort of stuff. But Hail Caesar?
I love Hail Caesar.
Are you on crack?
I love it.
What is wrong with you?
Oh, it's so good. Funny. So many bits.
The dance sequence with Channing. Channum.
The mermaid sequence. The comparative religion scene cracks me up. The Clooney trying to understand communism is amazing. I do also love Oh Brother.
What do you stand on Intolerable Cruelty?
I didn't hate it. Quite like it.
Okay. James, favorite Coen Brothers movie?
Big Lebowski, not even close.
All right, excellent stuff. Okay. That was less controversial.
Chris is like, that is the correct answer we made.
It's not the correct answer.
It is
not
the correct answer.
It is not the correct answer.
What's the correct answer, Chris?
The correct answer, Helen, is burn after reading. Stop it! Stop laughing at me
Shoot
at my choices.
After watching.
What? How dare you? How fucking dare you? No, I love burn after reading, but best Coen Brothers movie is probably Miller's Crossing.
That's like your opinion, man.
Anyway, Ethan Coen and Joel Coen, they made all those amazing movies together and Hail Caesar as well. And then after many, many years together, they've decided to go their separate ways creatively for a little bit. And Joel Coen went off and made The Tragedy of Macbeth. And then Ethan Coen has gone off and made, well, a Coen Brothers movie, Driveaway Dolls, which is about two girls, two lesbians, who embark upon a road trip and get involved with a bunch of ne'er-do-wells and criminals and people who, frankly, belong in the Coen Brothers movie. But he has not just made this movie by himself. He has made this movie in tandem with his wife, Trisha Cook. John Nugent, I believe it was, we sent along on Zoom recently to have a chat with Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook about a very bizarre, very funny movie. Here it is. Enjoy the interview, not the movie. Enjoy the interview. With Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook.
We are thrilled and honored to have Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook on the Empire Podcasts. Welcome. How are you both?
Good. How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
How is it doing days like this for the two of you? I mean, for listeners who don't know, you know, you're obviously husband and wife and also creative collaborators. Is it, do you work well together doing stuff like this?
Stuff like this, you mean interviews, promoting the movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. It's been, I mean, this is the first time I've done anything like this with Ethan, but, you know, I mean, we get on well and we kind of enjoy each other's humor. So I think that we have fun, you know, doing these interviews because we get to do them together. It's not as much fun when we have to do them alone.
Yeah. You know, it's a weird thing doing interviews for a movie because either you talk to the journalist or whatever, and it's it can be really stimulating. Either you kind of have a human conversation or for some reason you don't get each other and you go, whoa, that was a little grim. But generally, it's these have been good. This has been good. We go, okay, we're actually talking to somebody.
Yeah, for the majority of them have been, you know, very pleasurable.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we'll hopefully make sure that this conversation is not too grim. We'll keep the grim levels at a moderate rate. Yeah.
Especially if you have that stuffed animal behind you. You know, it's very soothing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The listeners can't see. This is like a Star Wars toy. This is a porg.
Okay.
I mean, it's very... I'm actually slightly embarrassed to have that in shot. I should have got rid of that. But
no, it's perfect. It's very comforting.
You got Trisha. You lost me there. So.
Okay. But what? Yeah, I mean, I guess you guys have worked together for a long time, right, Trisha? You've been an editor for the Coen films for a while. So does it all blur together? Do you like talk shop at the breakfast table, or do you guys kind of keep church and state?
Oh, yeah, church and state, for sure, which should be kept, you know, everywhere, certainly in this country, separation. We kind of leave work at work. And I mean, you know, we've been in a relationship for over 30 years, so we have a lot of other things that kind of occupy our time and minds, and you know, easy to talk about. But in the moment, we're making another movie and kind of promoting this movie, so it seems a little all-consuming.
What was your collaboration like before this movie? Because you know, you've worked on many films together. I assume with the mysterious Roderick James, right? What was that process like?
You know, weirdly, kind of like all our other, well, Trish can speak about her other work with other directors, but I don't know. For me, it's like all our collaborations with other people who work on our movies. You go, okay, I kind of understand and enjoy working with this person, and it's pretty easy and comfortable. in the case of me and Joel and Trish, and in the case of the directors of photography we've worked with, it's all pretty, there are a lot of familiar faces, and it's all pretty easy. Easy and stimulating because they're interesting people, you know?
Yeah. I mean, working with Joel and Ethan on past projects is different for me than working with other directors because, you know, they're two of them and their family. So there's a familiarity that doesn't exist with other directors. But as an editor, usually, you know, you're spending so much intense time with someone on a daily basis for, you know, 10, 12 hours sometimes a day that, you come to know the other person and you come to kind of understand their way of thinking. With Joel and Ethan, cutting wise, you know, I was usually cutting half of the movie or, you know, just like break up the scenes and I would cut some and they would cut some and then we would put them all together. And that certainly is not the case on other films that I've cut where you kind of have to, you know, have a vision. Not that you don't have a vision working with them, but you're only working on specific scenes at a time and then, you know, kind of seeing how they all work together.
Yeah. Yeah. And then with Driveaway Dolls, which am I right in thinking this has been 20 years sort of bubbling in the background to get to this point?
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. We wrote it 20 odd years ago. Tried to get it made then and didn't succeed. Tried to get it made with a friend of ours, another director, Allison Anders, and didn't manage to. So we thought, all right, that's too bad. We set it aside and then took it up again a couple of years ago. And we thought, well, maybe we should try and make it ourselves. And we rewrote it some and proceeded to make the movie. Yeah.
And did you start with the title? Did you start with Driveaway Dykes? Was it originally?
Yes. Yeah. We started with the title and thought it was good. And, you know, it seemed like it would be a fun movie to write. So we did. And it was a fun movie to write and, you know, kind of to come up with all of the, you know, just kind of silly, absurd ideas that we could.
It was like Trish was sitting in a bar and it was like, you know, Thomas Edison all of a sudden thinking, oh, a light bulb, artificial light. She thought, Driveaway Dykes.
Yeah, I've always likened the Driveaway Dykes to, you know, the invention of the light bulb.
Alexander Graham Bell, it just hit her. She gathered it out of the atmosphere and she came home really excited and said, Driveaway Dykes. And I went, oh, wow, man. It's actually kind of true. You know, we went, far out. That's too good an idea to not write the movie that would go with that title.
Yeah, I can't take sole credit. I was with a friend and we were kind of, you know, batting ideas around, on our third vodka. I'm not sure whose idea it was, but, you know, it was a collaboration.
Yeah, it's such a good title. I mean, you obviously, you've ended up with Driveaway Dolls, but in the film, at the end, it's revealed to be Driveaway Dykes. I mean, do we consider this, in your minds, is that the real title and Driveaway Dolls, the sort of
title? There's a square title, Driveaway Dolls, but we disavow it. In our minds, it's Driveaway Dykes.
It's the only title we use at home.
Okay. I mean, it's such a good title, and it really speaks to like the tone of the film, which is so like fun and like goofy and like I laughed so consistently through this film.
Oh,
I mean,
good.
It was just, I had such a good time with it. How did you land that tone, like in the writing and in the making of it?
Well, you know, it's all implicit in the title. How did we land the tone? I don't know. You just try to be faithful to your idea of what the movie is. You know, it's kind of trashy, kind of exploitation-y, kind of, a little transgressive and just fun. It's got to go. It's got to go. You know, it's got to.
And, you know, I mean, like, so you come up with ideas that you see, you know, like a basement full of soccer girls. Okay, that sounds, you know.
Yeah, where they would go in this kind of movie.
Yeah, and all of the girls would be lesbian, you know, I mean, which would never happen, but we gave ourselves license to kind of create that world, you know, a world in which ideally everyone, you know, was queer. Like, that would be my, you know, happy fantasy world.
And also, I mean, as you sort of allude to, it's a very much a queer film. It's a lesbian film. I would say probably very horny film. You know, a lot of the characters are just trying to get laid. I mean, was that just something you missed from seeing in movies?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not queer necessarily, because, you know, there's queer cinema, but queer cinema that's kind of lighthearted and fun and promiscuous and allowing the female characters to be promiscuous, which isn't something that I'd seen a lot of in film. To be carefree in that regard.
And, you know, all respect to you, John, and your little Star Wars toy there. I ask you, what character in Star Wars is horny?
It's a really good question. And the answer is, I think none of them. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We're serving an underserved audience, man.
All those horny Star Wars fans.
They need an outlet. They need an outlet.
It's true. Yeah, I realize after doing all of this press that, you know, I've just become, because, you know, there's a lot of talk about the time I spend in bars and my promiscuity. So heavy drinking, you know,
sometimes
sex driven person.
Sometimes it's hard to look at yourself.
Yeah, looking yourself in the mirror.
Yeah, I mean, Ethan, it's been a while since it's been a few years since your last feature film. And I'd read somewhere you'd gone a little bored of filmmaking. Is that still the case? Or with all this talk of dildos, are you a bit more having fun making films again?
That put me right back on my feet. No, it wasn't that I was bored with it. It's the last couple of movies I made with Joel were just very hard. I mean, in terms of production, just difficult movies. So they were not as much fun as, I don't know, it was less fun than it had been, so I took a little break. But this was just like a huge amount of fun. I mean, you know, we just liked everybody who worked on it. We really liked the actors. It was just fun. That's kind of what has rejuvenated me. And working with Trish, that being new, I mean, in this capacity, that was fun. It was all just fun. Don't want to overuse the word, but it was fun.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, you really feel it from watching it. Was it a hard thing to put together? Because it's a road movie. It's obviously lots of locations. There's lots of zany antics happening.
Yeah, the road movie, the location movie thing is, we actually shot the movie because the logistics are so difficult of traveling and shooting multiple locations. You basically don't, to the extent possible, you shoot it all in one place. We shot the movie in Pittsburgh, so different parts of Pittsburgh with a little art direction stood in for different parts of the East Coast, which is where the trip travels.
Although some of the road footage was shot in Florida and Georgia.
And Pennsylvania. Yeah, just some of the plates, the backgrounds for the car stuff.
When they're driving, we kind of went and found stuff in those locations to shoot. But all of the actual locations were, you know.
All the foreground locations were Pittsburgh.
Yeah, right.
Based on this experience, it sounds like you've both enjoyed yourselves. Is there going to be more collaborations like this? I was heard there was maybe the first in a trilogy.
Yeah.
Lesbian exploitation trilogy.
Exploitation, yes.
Lesbian B movie trilogy. We're in pre-production for the second one, Honey Don't. And we don't, you know, we don't have the third movie fully written yet, but
If you do two, you're obliged to say there are three. It's gotta be a trilogy, because I don't know what's a there isn't even a word for two of them. You're obliged to do the third. So we'll figure that out.
But yeah, the nothing connects them except the fact that they're genre films and they're, you know, have lesbians as lead characters. They're not these sequels or, you know.
Yeah, there's no series. No connected characters. No grand Balzacian design.
Well, there is Margaret Qualley back for this next one as well?
Yes. She is.
Yeah.
That was the lead this new one. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a detective story. She plays a detective named Honey O'Donohue.
Mm-hmm. And Ethan, are you going to, I'm sorry to ask you this. I'm sure this is a question you get a lot, but you and Joel working on something again? We'll obviously be thrilled to see you guys back.
We wrote something together. Me and Joel wrote something together this past summer that hopefully we'll do after me and Trish do this. We never kind of planned too far in advance, and especially now that we might drop dead in any decade or any year. We've written a movie, and hopefully Joel and I have, and hopefully we'll do it soon.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, you know, we hope and pray you won't drop dead anytime soon.
You hope and pray.
Truly it is. Yeah. Always a pleasure watching your work. So, I think that might be my time, but yeah, Drive Away Dykes, not Dolls. Such a pleasure talking, Ethan and Trisha. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
See you, man.
Okay, that was Ethan Cohen and Trisha Cook, and we will be talking about Drive Away Dolls later on in the review section. Something to look forward to. Right now, movie news time. There's quite a lot of movie news. The Oscars happened. We devoted most of the movie news section last week to the Oscars and to our predictions. How did we do? Did we do okay?
Pretty well.
Oppenheimer won 7 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director.
Mm. I think, you know, the only one that we kind of swerved on was Best Actress. But actually, we were very happy with the result regardless. So good.
And let's say it before he does. Chris did think it would be Lily Gladstone.
He did.
Well, I did say it was a possibility. Sorry, I didn't call it, but I did say I would not be surprised to find Twitter, wake up on Monday morning to find Twitter angry about Emma Stone winning Best Actress. And that's pretty much exactly what happened. But I also think that there's been a lot of graciousness and a lot of people going, actually, she was amazing. It was performance.
It was a great performance. And also, I think she was consistently gracious throughout award season and paid tribute to all of her fellow nominees, but in particular Lily Gladstone. And it's clear that the two of them have been genuinely friendly the whole way through award season and have been kind of hanging out together, I think, at a lot of these things. So, you know, it doesn't feel like she's taking something away, really, in that sense. Mm. I think they'll hopefully help each other out in future.
But it was solid. I mean, solid. I didn't see the ceremony. I slept in. I slept through the whole thing, which is a delightful way to experience the Oscars, because then you wake up the next morning, you see all the clips of the stuff that worked.
Yeah.
And that's fun. And so all the stuff that worked included John Cena presenting the Best Costume Oscar whilst completely starkers, except for a large envelope covering his nethers. That was very, very funny. Obviously, the aforementioned and aforediscussed Ryan Gosling, I'm Just Ken, which won Best Picture. And other weird things. I mean, Al Pacino completely banjaxing the announcement of Best Picture by just kind of just Al Pacino-ing it. The best way I could describe it, you know, with the now famous My Eyes See Oppenheimer thing. But Jimmy Kimmel, was he a good host? Anyone?
He was fine. I mean, I didn't think his opening monologue was an all-timer, but it was solid. There were a couple of very tired jokes, Killers of the Flower Moon, Running Time. I mean, even if James is making that joke over and over again, you know, it's really been run into the ground.
It's not a joke at this point for James. It's a political protest.
And I don't think it was for Kimmel. So that was a bit like, oh, I get it. But otherwise, I mean, I think he struck the right note of poking fun but not being mean. There were some absolutely lovely winners. I mean, The Last Repair Shop winning Best Live Action Short, if you saw the little girl from that, absolutely delightful. It wasn't a bad Oscars. It wasn't a bad Oscars. A couple of non-attendees among the winners, interestingly. Miyazaki didn't travel over. Oppenheimer wasn't there. Miyazaki didn't travel over to pick up Best Animation for The Boy and the Heron. Wes Anderson wasn't on hand. I guess he might be shooting.
No, he is shooting. He's shooting a new film, Wes Anderson. So this is interesting. This is the one thing that kind of slightly sticks in my craw a little bit, which is that Wes Anderson won Best Live Action Short for The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. His Roald Dahl adaptation. He did 4 Roald Dahl adaptations on Netflix. I think it was 4, maybe 3. And they were all very, very good. And he won Best Live Action Short as a result. I feel that that's somewhat unfair. It's hard because you shouldn't disqualify someone from that category because of who they are. But that is a world-class filmmaker who's already established
with a Netflix level budget that is far beyond anything that his competitors in that category will be able to muster. Even the catering on The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar will presumably cost more than most live action shorts that are being made in the world right now, where the average budget is, I'm guessing, something like $10,000, £10,000. In that ballpark, people's scrambling to get equipment together. They're shooting things on their phones. They're finding time to edit. Everything is very, very DIY. Then you have Wes Anderson, the most meticulous filmmaker in the world, going in with his professional grade A crew, his incredible cast of actors, including Benedict Cumberbatch, and a Netflix level budget. And it doesn't feel like the playing field is at all level for me. Now, I know you also feel that the same is true with things like animated shorts. Mm-hmm. But I don't really know what the solution here is, other than to perhaps introduce some rules to the category, which means you have to have a certain budget level, or maybe it's for first time filmmakers or people who haven't yet made a film. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But listen, I can't be mad about Wes Anderson getting an Oscar, because he deserves an Oscar because he's brilliant. But maybe not for this, is what I'm saying.
No, I get what you're saying, but like I say, we've been talking about this. You know, my argument has been, you know, in the animation category, you have long had people like Joanna Quinn and Les Mills have been making these hand-drawn animated films in Wales for years about this woman called Beryl, and they sometimes get Oscar nominated. They have been Oscar nominated, but they're up against, you know, the Disney movie, the Pixar movie that showed before the billion-dollar film that everybody's seen, and what do you know, they don't necessarily win. And that feels like a very non-level playing field, because I think a lot of the time with the Oscars, it appears that even in things like the animated shorts category, where the films are on average, I think about maximum 20 minutes, but often much less, you do get the voters going for the one that they saw when they went to see Toy Story 4 or they went to see Frozen or whatever it is. So that level playing field has never existed in the other short categories, I think. So, you know.
But that's not to excuse what happens here.
Then you either change the rules of the category, or you bring in a category that is specifically designed for newcomers.
Yeah, I suppose that's possibly the answer. But even in that category, even in animated short, you have a situation where, yes, you have the might of Pixar, but not every Pixar short gets nominated. But also, a lot of the Pixar filmmakers who are making those shorts are filmmakers who are cutting their teeth, who are slowly but surely dipping their toes into the water. It's not like those Pixar shorts are made by Brad Bird or Andrew Stanton or
Sometimes
Pete Docter.
Sometimes they have been, but I hear what you're saying, but at the same time, in terms of promotional weight, in terms of institutional expertise, and
of course,
help,
an eyeball eyes on the screen.
It's
of course,
a different level to some of, and especially.
I think we're making the same argument.
I think we are. I mean, I think we are actually agreeing. The animation categories have been really interesting in recent years, and they have, I think, tried to slightly change the rules. But the animation branch has been nominating really interesting stuff, and they have been nominating, you know, the cartoon saloons of this world, the very small animation houses that do extraordinary work with limited resources. And you want the Oscars to be celebrating that. And I know that it's difficult maybe to for those things to get visibility, but surely that's what awards are for, you know? So
absolutely. Listen, this is not intended as a criticism of The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, which is indeed wonderful. It's really great. Check it out on Netflix, and check out the other ones that Wes Anderson made as well. And it's not a criticism of Wes Anderson either. Nor am I saying that he should turn down the Oscar. No. I'm not saying this. What I'm saying is, put yourself in the shoes of, say, someone who made the director of The After, the David Oyelowo, I mean, who's managed to get David Oyelowo to be in their film. And even then, that's kind of maybe giving you a step up, because you have a major movie star in your short film. And you're thinking, am I with the Oscar here? Oh, fuck, Wes Anderson's in my category. I don't have a chance. If you are a young, scrappy, pugnacious filmmaker who has managed to get a film together, a short film together, and it's brilliant,
and it's gone on the Oscar shortlist.
It's gone on the Oscar shortlist. And then suddenly in comes the 800-pound gorilla immaculately dressed 800-pound gorilla that is Wes Anderson. And you're just thinking, well, this isn't really fair. But anyway, hey-ho. Anyway. Jimbo, let's welcome Jimbo back to the show. Hello, James. Anything else you want to say about the Oscars? after I get off my soapbox for 5 minutes?
No, not massively. Like, again, I think it was a really solid show. It was also the most boring show in living memory, but not because it was bad production, because we knew what was going to happen. Yes, a couple of slight deviations from the script, as it were, but it was very predictable. So it wasn't very exciting, nothing. And look, I can do without people getting slapped in the face excitement. I don't need that. But, you know, sometimes it's quite nice to go in thinking, I just don't know what's going to happen. You know, I want a little bit of showmanship to it. And it felt a little bit like, oh, I'm seeing this film again for the second time.
I'll tell you what, I would like them to get rid of the five nominees presenting the category, five former winners, rather, presenting the category, because I find that cringy. I would like them to emphasize funniness more in their intros, but also in their maybe host. I mean, some people were saying that John Mulaney made a good bid for presenting next year, and he was very, very funny. And I would very much like to see him present the Oscars. I must say that. Obviously, you know, Steve Martin and Martin Short remain my number one choice, but John Mulaney is absolutely right up there.
All right. So some other things happened as well in the world of movie news. Nev Campbell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nev Campbell had a truck loaded with gold bullion and backed up to her house, along with a note, presumably respectfully asking her to return as Sidney Prescott in Scream 7. And she accepted the note. What happened to the gold bullion, I do not know. But yes, Nev Campbell is back as Sidney Prescott in the somewhat troubled Scream 7. But now, it seems to be back on track with Kevin Williamson.
Yes.
Directing. Now, of course, Kevin Williamson is the guy who wrote the original Scream and Scream 2, for that matter. And he's back.
And he's not just writing this time, he's directing.
I don't believe he's writing at all. Guy Busick is writing.
It's being
written by Guy Busick, who wrote the last two. Kevin Williamson, I'm sure, is going to be writing. Maybe he's writing it with him, but Guy Busick, who wrote the previous two with James Vanderbilt, is going to be writing this one. So Kevin Williamson directing, which is... interesting, exciting. Jimbo, you excited by this?
I am
trepidatious?
A little bit, but only because on the recent Pilot TV podcast, we did a revisit of Dawson's Creek, which Kevin Williamson famously wrote and is, in fact, dreadful. And I thought it was going to be great and I was really looking forward to it, and it's not aged at all well. That's not to say that Scream isn't good, and that's not to say he isn't good, but it has certainly made me slightly concerned. I also, and I'm going to say this now, predict that Sidney Prescott is going to get murdered horribly in the prologue to this film.
Get out of here.
No.
I refuse.
Yeah, it's going
to
happen.
But then they're without a leading lady again. So they have to start all over again.
Will they go with Nev possible as a leading lady? I don't know. I don't think that she's going to come back unless it was a particularly large truck filled with gold bullion just to end Sydney's story in that way.
Well, it would need to be, if you jive in the prologue, then it doesn't need to be quite as big a truck.
Oh,
it's just like a mid-sized truck.
I think it should be a bigger truck in that
maybe
case.
The truck could be the murder weapon that she gets. A truck reverses perhaps into her and is driven by Ghostface.
And she's crushed by the gold bullion.
Yes, she
in
is,
the truck.
Yeah. And it's a bit like Frank Drebin in Naked Gun 2.5. It's like, actually, I reversed over my last two victims. Luckily, one of them turned out to be Sidney Prescott. Maybe it's a little bit like that. I don't know. Listen, I don't think that... I think her story ended very nicely in Scream brackets 2022, Scream 5. And she deserves her happy ending. Not that way. Stop it, you filthy-minded beggars.
Probably both.
And probably she does. She does, quite frankly, with Mr. McDreamy, mm-hmm, her husband, Mr. Patrick Dempsey. Not a bad-looking fella to be spending your retirement with. But I don't know. I just think dragging her back into this, it has much potential to muddy the waters and to tarnish her legacy. And I think leave Sydney alone, basically. But, you know, she's signed on the dotted line. So... she's back. If she is back, I think she should either be Ghostface or stay alive to the end of the film. I do not want to see Sidney Prescott dying.
I would like her to stay alive. Thank you very much. Please and thank you.
Thank you. Please and thank you. Venom.
Yeah, he's taking an unexpected direction in that we now know that his next film will be about exotic dancing.
Yes, that's right. Venom strips.
Venom X Magic Mike, The Last Dance. Or
oh my
rather,
word.
Venom The Last Dance is what they're calling the film.
Tom Very Hardy.
Oh, no. Yeah, it has a title. It's happening. It's a film that's coming out this year.
Venom, The Last Dance is coming out in October. We knew it was coming out in October. We didn't know it was called Venom, The Last Dance. We thought it was going to be called Venom 3, but that wouldn't make any sense because the last one wasn't called Venom 2. So this one is called Venom, The Last Dance, which does seem to indicate that either this is a sports documentary about Michael Jordan or a very sexy dance movie, or maybe this is the final Venom movie.
Yeah. Well, we can hope for one of those outcomes.
Yes, indeed.
Or more than one. No
more
judgment.
Than one. More than one. I'd love a pivot into sports documentary. That'd be pretty wild. And I took that personally. Anything else you want to talk about in the world of movie
or
TV news?
Speaking of superheroes, The Batman Part 2.
The Batman.
Has been pushed back to 2026, which can't be a huge surprise to anybody, because I feel like if it was going to be 2025, we would have heard a bit more about it by now. So yeah, it's now expected on the 2nd of October, 2026. I'm sure you're going to want to mark that in your diaries. So that's 4.5 years after The Batman. But in the meantime, we'll have The Penguin due later this year, with Colin Farrell's lovely face being hidden under a mess of nonsense once again. And that gives them a chance to have Superman appear before another The Batman. and I think Joker will be out first as well, won't it? Yeah, so...
Yeah, but those won't be part of James Gunn's DC.
Of course, they're different.
DCU.
Universe.
Yeah. Yeah. It is still confusing because they're planning to do The Brave and the Bold, which is the in James Gunn, not in James Gunn, it's not like Quantumania, but in James Gunn universe version of Batman, will be separate to Robert Pattinson, who, of course, is separate to any Batman who may or may not show up.
I'm so confused.
In Todd Phillips' Joker movies. But yeah, it's exciting. It's interesting. I like the first movie, so I'm looking forward to seeing the second one. And of course, if we're talking about James Gunn's DCU, then...
When aren't we?
When are we never? James Gunn announced this week that Peacemaker Season 2 is finally happening with John Cena, who may or may not be clothed, although he wasn't clothed for much of Season 1, in fairness. And I'm excited about that because I really liked Season 1. And that's going to be shot at the same time as Superman, which means that James Gunn, who is a Superman but not Superman, will not be able to direct all the episodes of Season 2, as indeed was the original intent.
Fair enough.
He can't do that. Yeah. He has written all the episodes, and the Viola Davis-led Waller season will be going after Peacemaker Season 2 instead of before, as it had been the plan.
All right.
Hey. It's Thursday. It's Thursday, March 14th, and that can mean only one thing.
Pie Day!
James is tired again. He is struggling to stay awake. I am looking at his eyes. They involuntarily closed just a second ago. Luckily, doesn't have to record pilot after this.
I am flagging. I have post-travelodge distress.
You're Randall flagging.
Yeah.
Well, the best way to get James excited right now is plug-in. That's right. What?
Oh, no.
Plug in the new issue of Empire, of course, is what I meant.
Thank God you finished the sentence.
Yes. Hell's Bells, the new issue of Empire is on sale right now. It has hit the shelves of all good and evil and virtual news agents, and it's a belter of an issue. On the cover, I'm going to say, because I wrote the feature, is Furiosa, but it's not mediocre. It is very, very exciting indeed. It is probably my most anticipated movie of 2024. I spoke to George Miller. I'm the producer. I spoke to...
What's just happening?
I don't know.
Wow, that is a great
joke
for anybody.
He's delirious and I don't know what's happening.
Anybody under 30 is going to be just baffled.
I mean, even 30 might be generous there.
I spoke to George Miller, who, of course, is the mastermind behind the Mad Max series and should have won the Best Director Oscar for Fury Road.
Yes, he should.
A few years ago. And he's back. So I spoke to George Miller, who directed it. I spoke to Anya Taylor-Joy, who plays Furiosa. And we talked for a long time, George Miller and I, about why Charlize Theron is not returning to play Furiosa in this. It's a prequel to Fury Road. That should probably explain it right there. Don't know why we spent so long talking about it. I spoke to Chris Hemsworth, who plays the film's bad guy and twisted father figure to Furiosa, a character called Dementis. which should give you an idea of what we're in for from Chris Hemsworth, who was great. These were the first interviews these people had done about this movie, and they were all terrified about what they could and could not say. It's a really, really fun feature. There's a lot of great stuff about the making of the film in there. And if you want to know more about Furiosa before it debuts in May, then I cannot recommend it highly enough, says the man who wrote the feature. Anything else in there that I didn't sully with my words?
Yeah, loads. So we talked to Alex Garland. In fact, Alex Garland wrote exclusively for Empire about his new film Civil War, not to be confused with one involving Captain America.
Hang on a second. I love that film.
We have the directors of Abigail, which is the vampire ballerina movie, talking to us about that. We have a reunion of Sopranos creator and some cast for the 25th anniversary of The Sopranos.
25 years, Jesus.
25 years. We have a bunch of us wrote little tributes to the late, great Carl Weathers, looking back on things like Rocky, Predator, The Mandalorian, Arrested Development, all the greats. We've got a look at Jerry Seinfeld's Pop-Tarts movie. That is a thing.
It's a real thing. It's a real thing.
A real thing.
No, that is an actual thing that exists.
I mean, it is incredible. Got Zack Snyder talking about Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver.
Also a real thing that exists.
Andrew Scott talking Ripley. First look at A Gentleman in Moscow with Hugh McGregor and Mary Elizabeth Winstead. So much more.
So much
Chris,
stuff.
Chris, you've got Wonka in your section.
Wonka. Paul King and Simon Farnaby.
I mean, yes. What great guys.
My section's the best section. Just ignore all the other sections.
Wow. Okay.
Or obviously the Furiosa feature. Go and read that. And then just frame it on your wall. It's beautiful.
Wow.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, there you go.
Beautiful.
Anyway,
thing.
It's a very good issue.
It's a great issue. I apologize in advance for my feature. There's probably a stupid joke in there or two somewhere. But yeah, it's great, great issue on sale right now in all good, evil, and virtual news agents. Thank you in advance for your interest and your support. Isn't that much better than when I used to demand that they pay my wages, you motherfuckers?
It's much better.
See how I've grown as a person? It must be because of the plugin.
Wow.
Time for another guest.
Oh, God, please.
Okay, excellent. Philip Noyce. We like him, don't we?
He's Noyce.
Noyce. He is one of Australia's finest filmmakers, mate.
Okay.
He is. He directed, of course, Deadcom.
Yeah, brilliant movie.
Deadcom. He directed Rabbit Proof Fence. He directed The Quiet American with Michael Caine. He directed, of course, the 1-2 punch, the double whammy of Harrison Ford's Jack Ryan movies, Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger. He directed Salt. And it's hard to direct Salt because it just sits there. And yet he directed it. That's how good Philip Noyce is. And now he is back as a director with this week's Fast Charlie, which is on Prime Video as of today, Friday, the 15th of March, the Ides of March. Beware the Ides of March, but do not beware of Fast Charlie, for it stars Pierce Brosnan, Bronholm himself, as a hitman with an accent. He doesn't do an Irish accent in this. He did an American accent, and it really threw me. Bonds shouldn't, by rule, attempt other
American
accents. Unless it's Daniel Craig in Road Logan Tradition. Lucky. No.
Logan Lucky.
But, you know, and occasionally I'll allow it.
Okay.
But,
just,
you know,
like for special occasions.
Yeah. But like T. Daltz shouldn't really stray from his accent.
No, that's
Roger Moore didn't stray from his
never.
Accent. Sean Connery couldn't stray from his accent. So it just, it throws me.
Mm-hmm.
It throws me.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Pierce Brosnan, very charming in this movie. Agent hitman who finds himself embarking upon a rip-roaring rampage of revenge. But oh no, wouldn't you know it, there's a complication.
What?
He's falling in love with Morena Baccarin, who plays a taxidermist whose path crosses with his. They intersect.
But not is that what way. The kids call it these
hey,
days?
Hey, come on now, steady. So anyway, Philip Noyce hasn't happened yet, but I am reliably informed that it will in about 3.5 hours. So hopefully it was great.
Fantastic.
Here it is. And if it doesn't happen, then I'll just cut this whole bit out and we're none the wiser. Here's Philip Noyce. Enjoy.
Thanks for doing this. Whereabouts in the world are you at the moment?
I am in Hollywood, California, the heart of Hollywood, California. Opposite me lives the head of Netflix. Across the other way is a famous screenwriter. You know, I'm in the thick of it here. the heart of Hollywood.
You can't escape movies even if you wanted to.
Could not escape them. Don't want to anyway. Don't know anything else. Have been saying action and cut and being paid for it. Now I'm 73, about to turn 74. Someone's been paying me to say action and cut since I was 18 years old. Believe it or not.
Oh, my God.
I have not had another job since I dug my last sewage ditch, which earned me enough to make my little short film about the sex fantasies of a teenager, a subject that I return to in my memory, of course. That was the last time I had another job, when I was 18 years old.
Wow. Was there a fallback position if it had all gone horribly wrong for you?
There was always a fallback position, and that was a teacher's college scholarship that I had, which would have indentured me for 10 years, and I would have been sent like that character in the film Wake in Fright.
Oh, yeah.
Who's sent out into the outback and, you know, has to teach kids for a certain period. That's the life I was avoiding. And it was that film and that the adventures of that gentleman that convinced me that I should keep trying to avoid that life.
Quite right too. I thought it was a life of boozing, of being incredibly sweaty, of taking pot shots at kangaroos and pot shots at the locals and going slowly mad. So I can see why you'd like to avoid that.
Yeah, it was the slightly mad part that I didn't go for.
It's a hell of a film, though.
It was a hell of a film. Not an Australian film, as it turned out, although it was an Australian subject. It was a Canadian director, Ted Kotcheff, who had a brilliant career, and a most brilliant career in Australia. But Australians, of course, have claimed it as an Aussie movie, but it's not really.
But what about filmmaking? Because you have been, as you say, you've been doing this since you were a bairn, as we say over here. And you have been very prolific, especially in the last few years. You've made a movie every 2 years, pretty much, and Fast Charlie just being the latest. So, you know, are you still finding it easy-ish to get films off the ground in America?
No. I mean, it was easy-ish. Easy. No, it was easy. It was genuinely easy. It was a big easy. When I was working within the Hollywood studio system, for better or for worse, as fast as I could churn them out, they'd have them ready with, you know, stars, scripts. Well, actually, the thing that came first was the publicity material. They always preceded making the film with, you know, a huge sales effort to sell the film to people all around the world, which is Hollywood's great achievement, you know. Rome did it with a sword, but Hollywood took the hearts and minds with movies.
Yeah.
That was easy. Now it's a struggle because I'm no longer working within the studio system. I'm making truly independent films. And the traditional way of financing those films is through pre-sales. I'll explain it to you.
Yeah.
So you get Joe Blow, the film actor, to be your star. Then you take that star to a sales company who give you an estimate on how much money you could raise between the script, you, the director, and that particular star. Then you get a budget done and you have to see if the money that could be resold around the world equals the amount of money you need. Well, what we know in the last few years is that the whole system of distributing films, of exhibiting films, has collapsed. It's completely collapsed. So there's a whole market, a whole way of financing films that was valid for the last 30 years that no longer works. It's completely broken. So it's hard. It's hard out there. Hard to get movies made. You know, I've had several movies with what I would call great bankable stars. only to get back the estimates. No, sorry. What's your budget? 15 million. Well, I can raise 7 on that star, not 15. Oh, back to the drawing board. So it's not easy, but it is easy in another way, in as much as you're your own boss. You can make your own decisions. They're not made for you by, you know, a studio. On the other hand, the studio system really does give you certain creative freedom until that monumental day that you have your first test screening. Because the studio system is all based, and it has been since 1923, on out-of-town test screenings. We used to go down to Orange County back in the 20s. Now we go as far even as Las Vegas or Phoenix to do a screening. But, you know, and there's a set of rules. If you get 70, you're in trouble. If you get below 70, you're in big trouble. If it gets below 60, you're in awful trouble. If you get 75, you might get out of trouble. That's 75 out of 100 on the audience rating. If you get above 80, you're in for a good time. If you get above 90, wow, you're home free, baby. Your movie's going to get a big P&A spend, and, you know, they're not going to bother you. I've got 25 and I've got 94. So I have a big range of studio experiences, where I was beaten up for months, or where, you know, the truck was backed up with money and I was told, whatever you want, just finish the movie. Anyway, that was the studio system. Now I'm working in the system of, you've got to find an actor who is bankable to make your movie.
Fast Charlie obviously stars Pierce Brosnan. Is Pierce one of those actors? And when you say, okay, I've got Pierce Brosnan on board now, that unlocks the budget level that you need? Or are you still having to constrain yourself in a way with the budget?
No, you've always got to constrain yourself. But necessity is the mother of invention, and you will do something out of necessity. And Fast Charlie is a perfect example of that, because 5 days before we started shooting, the producer announced that there was no money. Not a little money, no money. That everyone had to go home. That the bridging finance had fallen through. And I got together with Richard Wenk, who was the writer. And I said, what are we going to do? And he said, well, why don't we just see if you've got any money, and then we'll just write whatever money you're told you do have.
Wow.
And so that started a process that went on every day during that film. And if you've seen the film, mm-hmm. you'll notice in the first couple of minutes that there's a long executive producer credit list, 26 of them. Well, each of those 26 came in once we sent out the SOSs around America for money. Some of them came in for $10,000 and some of them came in for up to $2 million of investment. And as a result, that's why they've got front credits on a movie as executive producers. And the movie was made week to week, day to day, with reinvestment of small amounts of money by, 26 different investors.
Wow. So you really have to cut your cloth to suit at that point.
My God. We have to cut our cloth to suit. And I would come home. Warwick Thornton, the DP, is a great chef, would start preparing a meal, because I was staying in a house with him in New Orleans. And while I would watch my rushes, and then I would work out what I had to do the next day, and then I'd send a note to Richard Wenk and say, Richard, I've got to shoot 10 pages in 12 hours. It's not going to happen. Here's the scenes. Can you reduce those 10 to 5? And I'd wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, as one does when you're shooting a film. And there would be 5 pages telling the same story as yesterday, 10 pages told, rewritten by Richard. We'd go out and film it. And that's the reason why the film runs 90 minutes. We only had 90 minutes worth of money to spend. It's.
I mean, that's amazing. That is astonishing.
It is amazing. It is amazing. It's amazing that we got through it. It's amazing that we finished shooting. It's amazing that we finished editing. It's amazing that we were able to raise the money to put a music on the film. It's all amazing. But it was so wonderfully ridiculous that it was self-generating in terms of energy and so on, because I felt to myself, okay, been doing this since I was 18, haven't had any other job. Am I going to be defeated? Am I going to be defeated now? No, I've never been defeated, and I won't be on this one. And so, you know, in a way, it made me more determined, and more determined to cut corners, more determined to engage the audience, you know. Necessity really was the mother of invention. There was no one to bail us out on that movie, you know. And many days the crew went on strike because they hadn't been paid.
Wow.
That roller coaster off screen behind the camera was, you know, almost as much pleasure as watching the movie when it was finally finished, just because there were so many obstacles. And so to overcome them, you felt a great sense of achievement. You know, we were told, oh, you can't have drones. It's too expensive. Because nowadays, you know, you've got to get a drone operator and a safety this and a safety that and everything. And I said, all right, okay, so we can't have a drone. So my second unit director, who's been working with me now for 10 years in my film company and as a partner, Warren Thompson, he went to Best Buy and he bought a drone for $1,100. He used it. He would use it on taking all the wide shots in the movie. And then at the end of the movie, he went back to Best Buy, complained that something hadn't worked, and got our money back. which is the second time we've done that. And we're getting better and better drones each time we buy one.
It's interesting as well, going back to what you said earlier on about the test screening process and having a 95 in your career, or 94, and then a 25 at some point.
Put in prison danger, 94.
I mean,
ship it. That's all they could say. Ship it.
I mean, it's an amazing film. So,
and then there was Salt. Salt, where we had two versions. One was the producer's version, and one was my version.
Right.
And I thought, how are we going to solve this? So I said, let's have a test. Let's have a test screening. And so we went to Vegas, and we're waiting after the screening. We're waiting. There's all the studio people over there, and me, and the editor. And someone else was with me. I can't remember who it was. One of the producers. We're over here. We're by ourselves. They're all waiting. They're expecting that the person will come out with a piece of paper, and that will be our guillotine. And they'll cut us off. They'll go with the studio cut, the producer's cut. Anyway, they come out and it scored 84 in 4 quadrants, meaning under and male and female. Under 25, over 25, was all 84, and so Amy Pascal said, "Ship it."
The director's cut won the day.
The problem was solved.
It was like when they declare a new pope; the smoke was billowing from the chimney stacks. I love that. May I ask though, what was the 25?
The 25 was The Quiet American after 9/11. If you remember, The Quiet American is Graham Greene's novel about a CIA agent set loose in Vietnam in the 50s, who arranges for a terrorist attack to occur in a square in Saigon, which kills a lot of people. Now, this was not a very popular subject post 9/11. Idea that America might be a sponsor of terrorism when they've just been attacked in the most horrific way.
Yeah.
Eventually, with time, we worked our way up towards 60. The memory being what it is. And I don't think we made that many changes to the movie. It was just time that repaired the score in a way.
Wow. I mean, that blows my mind. I mean, because famously you've had ups and downs within the studio system in your time. So for every Patriot Games or Clear Present Danger, there was a sliver or a sink.
Patriot Games wasn't a big score to begin with.
Really?
Yeah, we had to reshoot the ending of that one because they didn't feel that the original ending, which was that Sean Bean and Harrison Ford are in a fight to the death on a rock in the ocean, and then they go into the water and one man drowns and one man doesn't. And they did not think that that drowning of Sean Bean's character carried enough retribution. we had to restage while the buses were going past with advertising the imminent opening of the movie. We were reshooting the ending. And if you probably can't remember that far back, I can just. What happened was that we had to arrange that Sean Bean was killed by his own desire to harm, in as much as he slipped back and fell onto an anchor while he was fighting the Jack Ryan character. And that was the ending that we went out with a week and a half later, with the last reel being mixed as the first reel was being shown to the press. We ran the film over to the Directors Guild with the last reel sound joining the picture so we could show it to the critics on the Monday before it opened. Anyway, Hollywood stories.
Philip, I've got to let you go in a second, but I just want to bring it back to Fast Charlie to finish off. It's fascinating to me hearing everything you've said about how the production went down. Because what you've made is a film that feels to me very much in the fashion of great 70s thrillers. There was a little bit of Charlie Varrick going on.
A lot of Charlie Varrick, you know. Yeah. Wasn't that a great movie, you know?
Oh, man. My God.
Really great. Don Siegel, made such a good movie. And yes. Our ending and his ending occurs. Well, his ending is on an aerodrome, but it's where there's a car junkyard. Cars are parked on top of each other, and our ending occurs in a car junkyard, just like his action finale, which was my little homage to Kill Charlie Varrick, the movie. You know. Which I enjoyed so much. The character that's hunting Charlie down, you know, was the inspiration for the freak in our movie who's hunting our Charlie.
Yes.
Our past Charlie.
Yes. Absolutely.
So there was a lot of inspiration from that movie and other movies of the 70s, which were characterized by lack of money, an independent spirit, and an independent mind in overcoming the lack of money. Watching that film, you know, was so inspiring to me because I realized that while I was shooting in the studio system, I had way too much time, that Siegel, you know, would choose when to use a close-up, which means another setup, you know, and would often have whole sequences in wide or mid shots or two shots. And, you know, and that I was maybe a little self-indulgent compared to those pioneers of the 70s. Mm. So there's a lot to be learned from the independent film movement of that era when, you know, a series of notable directors were breaking out of the studio system and financing their films outside that system, although that film eventually was distributed by one of the majors.
Philip, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to let you go, sir, but it's been a joy. Okay, thanks so much for your time.
Chris, thanks very much. Look forward to talking to you again.
Take care.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Philip Noyce talking about Fast Charlie. Check it out. Check it out on Prime Video. But there are other films, and they're in cinemas this week. We've talked about Drive Away Dolls already. We talked about Trisha Cook and Ethan Coen, but we haven't talked about the film itself, Hell's Bells.
Yeah.
Tell us about it, please.
So this is a proper caper. So we're set in the late 90s, and Margaret Qualley plays Jamie, who is this very loud, proud, outspoken, very sexually liberal lesbian woman who goes with her much more buttoned up, much more kind of small-c conservative friend, Marion, who's played by Geraldine Viswanathan from Blockers. They basically have to travel down to Florida for reasons, and they take a drive-away car, which is basically a rental car that they're returning to another rental depot, right? That's the kind of deal. Yeah. So you get a slightly cheaper deal on your rental car. And they're driving down from Philadelphia to Tallahassee. But unbeknownst to them, there is something hidden in the trunk of their car and some hitmen are after it. So cue nonsense. And I say this with love, like total nonsense about what is in this suitcase to begin with is a bit crazy. And then also the reasons people are after it are also fantastically silly. And I had a lot of fun, you know, learning what that was and kind of figuring out more about it. There's lots of small supporting roles. You've got people like Pedro Pascal, Matt Damon are in this.
Bill Camp.
Beanie Feldstein as one of their friends back home and also a cop. Loads and loads of like good supporting roles, but it's...
Coleman Domingo?
Sure, yes. Coleman Domingo also.
Just listen to cast now.
Yep. Miley Cyrus turns up at one point.
Yeah, it's true.
And it's just, it's very light. It's very kind of breezy. It doesn't take itself at all seriously. It's tempting to see this as, yes, oh, this is the funny Coen and Joel must be the serious Coen. Mm. And their films have kind of, you know, gone back and forth between the two of them. For what it's worth, I mean, when I spoke to him for the magazine, Ethan Coen said that is absolutely not the case and that his brother is hilarious. I think, and actually what he emphasized is that this is not just an Ethan Coen film, that this is very much Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook. So Trisha Cook, despite having been married to Ethan Coen for a couple of decades, identifies as a lesbian and certainly, I think, lived as a lesbian before her marriage. And so she is kind of bringing her culture essentially and her memories to shape the world of this script. It's a script that they've had for a long time. So it was originally not a period piece. And sometimes you can kind of feel that a little bit, if I'm honest. But I just find it funny. I find the two leads very charming. I liked all the little cameos. I thought the revelation of what's in the case was brilliant. I just had a good time with it. It is under 90 minutes. It's like, what, 84 minutes or something? Which, you know, you just get a bonus star just for that, as far as I'm concerned. But it is, I just really enjoyed it.
I'm with Ethan Coen on this. I think his, like, certainly his comments about the division of labor between him and his brother are absolutely right. And I say that mainly as the tragedy of Macbeth is significantly funnier than this.
Oh, boy.
But it's interesting you mentioned Miley Cyrus there, because obviously she is in it. And I'd completely forgotten that this has a series of weird 60s psychedelica interludes.
Yeah.
That absolutely baked my noodle watching this film. I could not work out what they were for. But I mean, look, I am not a seer of comedy. I'm not an expert in that genre, but I did find this quite acutely unfunny. I thought Margaret Qualley was very, very good. She's brilliant in The Leftovers. I think she's very good in this as well. You know, and I enjoyed a lot of the people in this, but I just found the script to be quite insubstantial and a little bit boring. Like, the plot didn't grip me. I found, with the exception of one or two genuinely good lines, I found the comedy just fell pretty consistently flat for me. It's interesting how this has been received. So this has been, some people have really liked this. We go this 4 stars. John Nugent, who is mad, gave this 4 stars. But some people have given this 1 star. Like, it really has polarized people in this. I'm probably... Yeah, you know, I'm not in the 1 star camp. I'm probably in the 2 star camp.
I thought you were. I thought you were in the kill it with fire camp.
No, not in the kill it with fire. Just lightly toast it. I would say would be from me.
Singe the edges.
Yeah, but like I have a spotty relationship with Coen comedy. For me, for every Big Lebowski, there is an intolerable cruelty which I just don't get. Like when they go full kooky wacky. You know, sometimes it just doesn't work with me. And I felt like this...
Sorry, that's a great phrase.
Kooky wacky.
Oh no, you've gone full kooky wacky.
You've gone kooky wacky.
Oh,
no. They went a bit kooky wacky here, but I don't think it's their... I don't think it's his strongest kooky wacky project. I think, you know, go kookier, go wackier, but more importantly, make it funnier.
I think it's pretty kooky. I think it's pretty kooky wacky. I think they have better kook. Well, see, we're
too many kooks.
We're lapsing into
too
that.
Many kooks. Spoil the broth.
But yeah, true.
There's only one Trisha Cook here.
I'm confused now. What's happening? We're lapsing into that trap of Lay and the Coen brothers. It's not the Coen brothers.
No,
this is Ethan.
It's a
but
Coen brother.
Yes, but you could see if you were given to that, you could very easily go, all right, Blood Simple's a Joel movie. Raising Arizona is an Ethan movie. Miller's Crossing is a probably both movie. Barton Fink is a Joel movie.
No, well, by that standard, sorry, Miller's Crossing is a Joel movie.
Well, maybe, but I also think there's a little bit of Ethan because Miller's Crossing very, very funny as well. But so is Barton Fink. But Barton Fink's just fucking weird. The Big Lebowski, but it's not as simple as that. But
no.
This definitely feels like a Coen Brothers tribute at times. But despite the kooky wacky nature of it, I also thought there was a kind of a sweetness to it, which made it work for me.
Mostly in Marion's character, I think. Yeah.
That relationship I thought was really lovely, and you get a chance for it to really, really grow, which is an impressive achievement in a very, very short film. Also, there's some lines that absolutely floored me, and there's a gag with a newspaper headline that had me laughing for a solid minute. I may have been one of the few people on the screen laughing, but it was very... very, very good indeed. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, Jimbo. Mm. What can I say? I enjoyed it.
You are easily amused.
We gave us 4 stars. 4 stars
madness.
For Drive Away Dolls.
Absolute certifiable madness.
There you go. There you go. You say you had a spotty relationship with comedy, Jimbo. Do you know who else had a spotty relationship?
Tell me.
Super Ted.
Another cutting edge reference for those under the age of 40.
Next up is Monster, the new film from Hirokazu Koreeda, the great Japanese filmmaker. And I can think of only one person in the world to review this movie, and that is James
Dyer. Now, this is a funny film. Oh, the comedy. Oh, all over the place. No, yeah, this is, do you know what? So this is kind of a family drama told in a Rashomon style, whereby it's...
Well, that's just your point of view.
Yes, indeed. Picked at sort of from three different angles. It stars Sakura Ando as Saori. She's a single mother. Eita Nagayama, who plays Mr. Hori, who is her son's teacher. Her son, of course, played by Soya Kurokawa. He plays the son Minato. And then the other main character is Hinata Hiragi's character, Yori. And he's sort of a boy in Minato's class. And so the first sort of part of this triptych is... the boy has had an incident at school. He seems quite disturbed by it. He throws himself out of a moving car, never go full ladybird. and his mother goes to school to essentially complain. And the scene whereby she has it out with the headmistress, who has suffered a recent bereavement, and there's a whole complication there as well, is fascinating because it's common sense butting up against sort of institutional obstinance. It's frustration. It's brilliantly acted, incredibly affecting. And you think you know exactly what this film is, what its tone is, what its genre is, and where your sympathies are supposed to lie. And then the film stops and it resets. And it starts again from Mr. Hori's perspective. And then it's almost like a satire. And it feels like a very different film covering the same events, but with slightly different overlaps. And your sympathies, again, are tugged in a completely different direction. And then it resets again, and is from a different perspective once more, and is, again, a different genre. It's more of a love story. And again, it has a real bittersweet feel to it. Like, it feels a very different thing. And I really like this. I thought it was very affecting. It's kind of Koreeda's fascination with family dynamics really comes to the fore here. But it's What it doesn't do, which a lot of these multiple perspective stories does, is pull back the curtain a little bit with each new perspective. So you see a larger picture. And by the end, you see the entire thing. You know exactly what it is. This asks more questions than it answers. And at the end, if possible, you are more confused than you were when it began. But actually for the good. Like, it's a really rewarding experience. It's quite dense at times. But yeah, I thought it was great. Mm-hmm. Really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it is slow. It's just over 2 hours. And there were times when I felt that it, you know, I was like, oh, we're just starting a new story. Oh, okay, fine. Some time still to go. But everything in it was well done. And the performances, in particular, the child performances, I thought were really, really impressive in this, really beautifully done. And I think it's just really fascinating to get into this idea of how well do we really know and understand each other? And even when we think we've got it all figured out, do we actually, and are our own fears and our own paranoias sort of shaping the way we're seeing the people around us? And that, I thought, it was kind of an, it gave you a lot to think about in that sense. I think I might've been a bit confused by the ending. I seem to have had a different read on it to most people and most reviews that I've read since. So I think I perhaps overanalyze that one, but
no, I liked your read on it. I'm obviously not going to mention it here, but it made me think about the ending slightly differently because I hadn't seen that in it when I watched it.
So I don't know if I'm sort of right on that or not, but I don't think it matters either way. I think it's just a way of seeing it, and whatever way you see it, I think it's a beautifully acted, beautifully directed drama.
And what's also interesting is the title, which is deliberately ambiguous, and your interpretation of that title again transforms and evolves as this film goes along.
Yes, very much so.
We should also mention that this is the last film of Ryuichi Sakamoto, the legendary composer who passed away before this film was completed. In fact, wasn't able to write a full score for this movie, and so only wrote a couple of pieces, and the rest is supplemented from newish work of his. But yeah, go and see it for that as well. 4 stars then for Monster, which is terrific. Finally, and very, very quickly this week, we have Warwick Thornton's The New Boy, which stars Cate Blanchett. But Helen, they didn't have Cate Blanchett with the budget. This is a fairly low budget movie, isn't it? An Australian film.
Yeah, it is. So it's set in a remote orphanage slash, you know, Catholic run orphanage in the 1940s in the outback. And a little boy played by Aswan Reid, who isn't named, the character isn't named, is brought to this orphanage in the middle of the night and greeted by Sister Eileen, played by Blanchett. She's like, oh yes, the priest who's running the place isn't here right now, but I'll take him. I'll sort of sign for him, kind of thing. So you've got this Aboriginal child who is kind of fascinated by and very in touch with the natural world. So he seems to have almost magical powers. He can conjure little balls of light. He can heal small hurts and things like that. And there's kind of a magical realist thing going on immediately. But it's about him sort of being absorbed into this world and sometimes butting up against it. He doesn't really have any interest in the religion that they're trying to teach him, in the sort of the manners and the mores that they're trying to impose on him. But at the same time, he is quite fascinated actually by some of the trappings of religion, by a statue that they have of Jesus on the cross. He finds that interesting. And as they discover some of his abilities and some of his powers and so on, Sister Eileen becomes convinced that he is a miracle child, you know, a sign from God, and is like redoubling her efforts to kind of draw him into the church and draw him into her religion. So there's definitely a very clear colonial discussion going on here about the attempt to erase Aboriginal culture and the attempt to conform and enforce Western culture onto an Aboriginal child and to wipe out his native understanding. Yeah. And that's quite affecting and quite emotional when you get into that. There's also a whole thing going on about Sister Eileen herself, who is living this very precarious life where she is not meant to be in charge of this. This is not a convent. She is not supposed to be the person running the place. And she's kind of hiding the fact that she is, for reasons that become clear as the film goes on. So it's a very delicate balance all round. And it's this very isolated little group of people in the middle of nowhere, you know, three adults and a bunch of children in this sort of vast open space. So yeah, it's a very kind of beautiful film. It looks gorgeous, you know, endless sort of rolling hills around them. And this small boy, I mean, I thought, Reid was fantastic in the sort of title role. I thought he was really, really moving without really saying almost anything. and you're focused on him and you're focused on his kind of like child's eye view of the world. But then you also have all these big ideas kind of feeding into the film and shaping it. So a little bit slow again, a little bit kind of, you know, small scale in some respects, but beautifully played and nicely put together, I thought, by Warwick Thornton.
Indeed, who also shot Fast Charlie, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Busy week for him.
A busy week for him. Maybe he was like Clark Kent and Superman and Superman IV, The Quest for Peace, and he was kind of double-dating and going back and forth in a restaurant.
Makes sense.
Between Lois Lane and,
and
whichever Hemingway is in that film. I think it's Margot, isn't it? Margot Hemingway is in that film?
I think so, not Margot.
Maybe. Maybe. Yeah, maybe. One of the Hemingway. Yeah. Certainly not Ernest. It's not
definitely
Ernest.
Definitely not Ernest.
It is definitely not Ernest Hemingway.
Do you know that Ernest Hemingway, as a journalist, got paid the equivalent of £21 a word in today's money?
I'm sorry, say again?
Mm-hmm. He got paid $2 a word, which in, 1930 or whatever, which would be the equivalent of $21 a day. Dollars, sorry, not pounds. A day in today's money.
For that money, I'd write a lot more than just A Farewell to Arms.
That's in his journalism, not even his books. Anyway.
Right. Don't even get me started. Anyway, 3 stars then for the new boy?
3 stars for the new boy.
Three stars for the new boy. There we go. And that is it. On that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. Next week sees release of Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. Yeah? So we'll be joined by... who are you going to call? Sydney Sweeney. That's right, the star of Immaculate, the new nun-based horror film, which is coming out next week as well.
There's so many nun-based horror films. There was one
a minute ago, and there'll be one in a couple of weeks' time, and one just beyond that as well. So that's very exciting. Sydney Sweeney, she's having a moment. And what greater pedestal for her to ascend to than the Empire Podcast? But who else are you going to call?
Oh, Ghostbusters?
Ernie Hudson.
Oh.
Only bloody Winston Sedmore on the Empire Podcast. Very, very excited about that. I don't know who's going to be doing that because that's happening when we're in Dublin. So that's going to be fun. That's going to be exciting.
Bring him over.
Bring him over. Yes. Ernie, are you busy? We could kidnap him.
We could.
Great idea. Apart from I'm your lawyer. As your lawyer, no.
Hey, look.
Plausible deniability.
If there's a steady paycheck in it, he'll be anything you want.
So if we just go £2 a word. Oh, that's Ernest Hemingway. Damn it. But yeah, if we just go, come over here. Come over here, Ernie Hudson. And then bag over the head onto the plane.
Again, as your lawyer, no, I don't recommend.
You're absolutely right. Sorry.
This.
They wouldn't let him on the plane with the bag over his head. They wouldn't get through my passport control. Bag over the head, into the hold.
Oh, no.
And then into Dublin, bag off the head. Great podcast. Yay, we're all friends. Mm-hmm. Back on the plane.
Yeah.
By which point he would have forgiven us.
Wow. It's a fascinating plan, Chris. It's just a couple of tiny little details that we need to work out.
You cannot be arrested for kidnapping someone in England and taking them to Ireland.
You absolutely can be.
Shit, really?
Yeah, afraid so.
Oh, God. Okay, I have to go and make some calls and burn some paperwork. Right. That is definitely it. And we'll also be joined by these two Egypts as well, which is fun and exciting. And we will be in Dublin. A couple of remaining tickets for the Laughter Lounge show on the 21st. So do come along and see us. It's going to be an absolutely cracking night. But until then, until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again, it's goodbye from James Dyer, who I think is actually asleep.
And so to bed.
He's just staring at me through eyes that have
glazed. The best part of this is
over.
I have to go straight from here to a 2-hour Netflix presentation and then go watch Roadhouse, so there will be no bed for me
Roadhouse
for a while.
Will wake you up.
I'm really excited about seeing Roadhouse if I can stay awake.
That's exciting. Yeah, there you go. It's also goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to prepare for our Dublin show the only way I know how, by learning the dialect and the accent of the local people.
Oh, God.
I'm going to blend in, disappear with any luck I've got to Grail already.
Jesus.
You best believe in ghost stories, Miss Swan.
You're in one.
Apparently, this is Irish accent. Jesus, what the fuck am I doing? Anyway, thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.